Hold into your seat tonight. I'll ask you to turn to Acts, the 8th chapter, if you would. We'll begin there in just a moment, looking at some things from God's Word. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you've had a great day. I have had a good day. I have slept well. I've eaten well. That's about it. You know, it's a tough job, but somebody got to do it. And I volunteer. Bruce and I talk about that. We've talked about that a lot since we've been here. It would not be good for Bruce and me to be in the same place too often. I can tell you that. Both fighting sugar issues, and we love to eat. But we're both small guys, so that works out fine. I will tell you tonight that I'm a little bit overwhelmed for a variety of reasons. My mom and dad are here. You know, I always want to do my best when my mama's around. I can tell you that. And I say this. You know, I don't know how much longer that she's going to get to hear me preach, because I don't know what will happen to me or her or my dad. But I always enjoy the fact that they can come, and I appreciate them being here. And there are a lot of people here tonight from Ball Knob and from Searcy, two places that, for me, have great meaning. The Christians in those parts of the country, parts of Arkansas, have meant a great deal to me. And I have been influenced a great deal, especially in my younger life. And so those of you who have made that trip tonight, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. It always encourages me to see you and to think that what I have to say from the Bible might be worthy of your coming. And so thank you. And thank you to all of you who are here. I want to mention one other thing before I begin. I didn't mention this yesterday, and I wanted to. You know him as James Taylor. Not the singer, but he's one of your members. I know him as Buddy Taylor. Buddy and his wife Peggy, who has, as I understand it, passed not too very long ago. When I was a boy, my dad preached in a little community called Citizenship, Arkansas. Had a polling place, and that's about it that I remember. But the Taylor family was so good to my parents, and Dad preached at that little church. And then when I went back to school at Harding, they asked me to come and to preach for them. And so those were some of my first experiences preaching the gospel. And Buddy and his brothers, especially, and all their families were great encouragements to me. So to have him as part of this church now and to see him, all that comes back to me. And I am so indebted to him and to his family for the encouragement that they gave me as a college student, trying to preach the gospel. And there's so many others here that I could name and would like to say something about you, but I am just a bit overwhelmed by it all tonight, because so many of you are here, and you have been such an encouragement to me. And I just need to make you understand as best I can how important you are to me and continue to be to me. So I want to thank all of you certainly for being here. I want to share something with you tonight that was shared with me a few years ago. And it's changed some of my thinking, particularly in reference to my work as a preacher. But maybe more importantly, to my work as a Christian. And so by talking about this tonight, I'm hoping that it maybe changes your heart a little bit as you consider the fact that all people need to understand the gospel and need to hear the gospel preached and taught to them. You remember in Acts 7, the message of Stephen. It was a lesson not very well received by the Jews of his day. And in verse 54 of Acts 7, the text tells us, Luke records, just when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth. Then it goes on to say, they took him out of the city and stoned him. They weren't too happy. They weren't too pleased with what Stephen had to say, to the point that they appeared to have even tried to bite him. And I think that may be some literal things to that too. I think we need to be thinking about that. They were angry about that. And the text goes on to tell us that great persecution arose. And then when you get into chapter 8 and verse 4, I want you to notice what is said in Acts 8 verse 4. Therefore, those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. Those of us who preach have used this many times as kind of a jumping off point to talk about the fact that we need to be out preaching the word. And I think that's a legitimate use of it. That's what these disciples, as they were scattered because of the persecution, that's what they did. But I want you to think about it and hold, just hold that thought and turn over to Acts 11 and verse 19 and listen to these words also recorded by Dr. Luke. This is Acts 11 verse 19. He says this, "Now those who were scattered after the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, preaching the word to no one but the Jews only." The language is not identical, but the language is very similar. And what I want you to notice with me tonight is that I think these two texts in Acts 8 and verse 4 and Acts 11 and verse 19 compose what I would call bookends. And in between is what I want us to look at tonight. What is said, and is there any significance in what happens between what is written in Acts 8:4 and Acts 11:19? I think there is significance for us. In that section of Scripture, you will notice that there are four conversions. There are four conversions that are very familiar to us. In Acts 8 chapter, you have Philip going and preaching in Samaria. Verse 5 tells us that he went and he preached Jesus to them. And verse 6 tells us what the outcome was. The multitudes with one accord heeded the things spoken by Philip. They saw Philip then do miracles. He was healing and he was performing other miracles. And verse 12 tells us that they believed Philip as he preached the kingdom and the name of Jesus. And it goes on to say that both men and women were baptized. And then you go down a little further in Acts 8, and it probably what may be, for many of us, the absolute most familiar conversion story, that of a eunuch from Ethiopia. And Philip meets him on a deserted road south of Jerusalem, and verse 35 tells us that Philip preached Jesus to him. We know the rest of the story. Then you get to Acts, the 9th chapter, and you have the story of the conversion of Saul. He is a man headed to Damascus to seize Christians, to bring them back to Jerusalem for trial. He is concerned about what they're doing and what they're teaching. And so he's made it his responsibility, a prime responsibility, to take care of this problem. And as he's going on the road, the Lord appears to him. And he tells him to go into the city. And when you go into the city, then it will be told you what it is that you are to do. And after 3 days, you'll remember that Ananias tells him in verse 18, Ananias lays hands on Saul. And the scales come off of his eyes because he has been blind. And ultimately, he is baptized. And then the fourth story that's in this parentheses, if you will, is the story of a man named Cornelius. The story begins by telling us the kind of man Cornelius was. And eventually it moves to another location and we hear about Peter who is in Joppa. And he has the vision of these unclean animals. And he's told that men are coming. And he says, and the Lord is telling him, I want you to, when these men come, I want you to go with them. He eventually, as you know, gets to Caesarea and eventually he, after several conversations and after thinking about it for a while, he eventually starts to put the pieces together and he gets it. He begins to understand why it is that he has come to Caesarea. And so he gets there and he ultimately preaches Jesus, again like Philip had done in Acts 8. And he preaches Jesus to Cornelius and Cornelius and his household. Verse 48 of Acts 10 tell us that Cornelius and his family were baptized. Four cases of conversion. And then when you move on into Acts 11, the first part of Acts 11, Peter has gone back to Jerusalem and he is sharing what has happened most recently with the conversion of Cornelius. And they react that this is important information for them to hear. And there's mixed reaction really about that. And then Luke picks up at the end, in verse 19 of Acts 11, Luke picks up the story again from Acts, the 8th chapter and verse 4. He says the same things. I want to ask you a question tonight. And when I talk about this, you may say, well, Kenny, I don't see that. And it maybe there's not the significance to it that I think there is, but I do think it's significant for a reason that I want to share with you. You know, the book of Acts is a historical account, but it isn't comprehensive. It's not comprehensive, nor is it exhaustive. The way men have titled this particular letter, it's called Acts of the Apostles. But I will tell you that it's anything but an exhaustive list of what the apostles have done. There is a sense in which it is the Acts of the Apostles, but it's not an attempt. The book of Acts is not an attempt to tell all. As a matter of fact, what Acts is, I would call it, it's Acts of primarily two of the apostles about a few things they did in their lifetime. I think that's a better title, although I wasn't there to help them title it. But I think that speaks a little bit better as to what Acts really was. And we are familiar with those two men, particularly Peter and then Paul's work. In the book of Acts, there are thousands of baptisms mentioned, right? In Acts 2, very quickly after the preaching of the Gospels was done for the very first time, the passage to Luke tells us that there were 3,000 who obeyed the Gospel on that occasion. And I would ask you, how many of those 3,000 can you name? I'm waiting. Yeah, that's true. We don't know. We really don't know their names. We're not told specifically what their names are. But in Acts, from Acts 8:4 to Acts 11:19, in between those two passages that tell us when the persecution of Stephen happened, those people scattered and they began preaching. In between that are four conversion stories where you know
about what they did. I think that's critically important because it's through these and other conversion stories that we know what to tell people to do if they want to obey the gospel. That's true. That's very true. But I want you to think in a broader sense about who these people were and the significance of them to us today. First, think about the Samaritans. Luke records that Philip went to Samaria. The Samaritans were a result of the Assyrian takeover. You know, 700 years earlier. And those Assyrians who had come in part anyway, to try to discourage insurrection. They would bring in foreigners, people from other cultures who spoke other languages, and they would bring them into these areas, and they would then intermingle in those areas, and eventually, over time, they married people who were from that area. And so, over a period of time, what you had was not the Jews who were the purebreds, but you had the Jews who were the half-breeds. And because of that, those who would reside in a place like Judea, where the capital was, or in a place like Galilee, which was in the north, those who would reside in those areas many times because they had to travel to and from those areas, but yet they would not go through Samaria. No, not at all. They didn't want to go through an area where these Samaritans lived. In John 4, beginning in verse 3, listen to these short verses that tell us, you remember the story, Jesus had to go there. And notice what's said. This is John 4, beginning in verse 3. Jesus left Judea and departed again to Galilee. Now listen to verse 4. But He needed to go through Samaria. He needed to go through Samaria? Did He have to go through Samaria? Did he have to take the road directly through Samaria? Well, something compelled Him to go through Samaria. I think I know what that is, although that may not be known to me. But the Jews would never have done that. And Jesus made it a point to go not only through Samaria, but He went to Samaria. And as you know from your study of John 4, that's where He met the woman at the well. In a great exchange that teaches us multiple lessons, after which we understand that she went into the city and said, "I've met Him." And then people began to come out to see for themselves who this man was, who claimed to be Messiah. If a Jew touched a Samaritan, we're told that they were to go wash because the Samaritan was unclean. And what I want you to think about is Philip went to Samaria and he preached to the Samaritans. And they were baptized for the remission of their sins. And when he finished that, he was called to go to another place. He meets up with a eunuch. And we're familiar with this story. We know this story. Here is what apparently is a wealthy eunuch, a wealthy Ethiopian. He's in a chariot, which probably meant that he had money. He was the treasurer of the queen named Candace. She was the queen of Ethiopia. He was in charge of her, of the wealth there. He was in a chariot and he is reading when Philip joins himself to the chariot, as we're told, he is reading from Isaiah. Now I want you to think about that. It's not just that. That doesn't seem odd to us. But I can tell you, well, he didn't have what I have. He didn't have what you have. And I guarantee you he didn't have an iPhone with a Bible on it. But he was reading from Isaiah. And he asked a question. Philip asked him the question, "Do you understand?" He said, "How can I?" And Philip joined himself and he began to preach to him. And he helped him understand. But he was reading at least part of Isaiah. We don't know how much he had, but whatever he had, it was rare. The written word would have not only been rare, but it would have been very expensive. He not only had it, but he was reading it, which most people even couldn't read. Or at least many of them couldn't read. And so he was reading from Isaiah 53 because he could. And because he was interested in what God wanted him to do. And he was trying to understand what it was that God wanted. He had been to Jerusalem. He was returning from there. He had over 1,000 miles away. He had been there to worship. And he said, "What I want you to think about." He was worshiping there, folks. But he wasn't worshiping in the temple. As a matter of fact, he was not only not worshiping in the temple, he wasn't worshiping even in the court of the Gentiles. Because Deuteronomy 23 tells us, I think the King James says, he was wounded. He who is wounded. That's God's way of saying he who is emasculated. Which is what the New King James uses. It's God's language to say he was a eunuch. And because he was a eunuch, he could not go in. He was a second class citizen. He didn't have the privilege that other people had. And Philip baptized him. Philip told him about Jesus. And what I love about that is it wasn't the preacher Philip saying, "Hey, how about being baptized?" It was the eunuch who said it. That's a thrill. I'll tell you what. I told you, I mentioned that I think yesterday. When somebody looks at me and says, "I'm ready to do what the Lord wants me to do," there is nothing better. And if I could talk to Philip, I think he would have said, "That was a great day." But Philip baptized him. And then you get to Acts 9. The conversion of a man named Saul. And I want to ask you a question. If you had lived, I'm just going to say this. If you lived anywhere, Judea, Samaria, Galilee in the first century, and a Christian had come up to you, let's say Philip had come to you and said, "Well, I want you to write down your top three prospects for the gospel." How many of you would have said, "Well, I got one, Saul of Tarsus. He's at the top." If you would have mentioned Saul of Tarsus, you wouldn't have said at the top. You'd have probably said at the bottom, and you wouldn't have said it too loudly because you thought he might hear you and come after you. Acts 9:1 tells us that he was still breathing out threats and slaughters against the disciples. Now, as I've read the New Testament, I don't know many people about whom it is said he was still breathing threats and slaughters against the disciples. And the idea of still breathing is one who is incessantly bent on accomplishing the destruction of the objects of its resentment. I just like the way that sounds. It makes me sound smart. But what it really says is he went at it. And he was not going to be denied, nor was he going to be defeated. He was breathing out threats and slaughters. When in Acts 26, in the third time, the account of Saul's conversion is mentioned as he is preaching and talking to Agrippa and trying to help him understand. Acts 26 and verse 9 says this. This is what Paul would say to Agrippa. He would say, "Indeed, I myself thought that I must do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. This I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. And I punished them often in every synagogue and could compel them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly outraged against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities." Now I'm going to tell you something. It doesn't get much clearer than that. And that's coming from the man himself who was doing it. Now, he's speaking after his conversion, obviously, but he's saying, "Listen, he couldn't have been any worse for the Christian than what I did to him." And verse 19 tells us, he looked at King Agrippa and said, "Therefore, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision." I think what that tells us very clearly is whatever the Lord Himself had told Saul to do, that's what he did. He was baptized, as we know. He began to preach in Damascus. Heat came. And this is something about Acts that we don't get in Acts. You know, in Acts, we think he immediately went to Jerusalem. But no, he left. If at least for 3 years before he came back to Jerusalem. And that's when he came back and Barnabas said, "Hey folks, this is a good guy. We need to accept him." But listen, I'll tell you, had I been one of those early Christians and Saul came back to Jerusalem and I'd been a member of that church and he said, "Listen, I want to be a part of this," I'd have said, "I don't think so. I'm not quite sure about it." Barnabas would have had to talk pretty straight to me. He'd had to be pretty convincing for me to say, "All right, let's let him in. Let's let him be part of us here." But Saul of Tarsus became obedient to the faith. And then you get to Cornelius in Acts 10, as I've mentioned. He was a great man. We read a lot about Cornelius. Cornelius was you and me. He was a Gentile. He, like all the Gentiles, was hated by the Jews. At least most of them hated the Gentiles. Obviously, Cornelius himself had a pretty good reputation among those who were Jews. But you know the story. Not only was he a Gentile, but he was baptized. And the importance of that, folks, is that he was the first, as we know, the first Gentile convert. And then when you do get to Acts 11, as those who were preaching were going to Antioch and they were preaching there and more Gentiles were being converted. And I think it's important because they were converted to the Lord. They had the Lord talk to them and they turned to the Lord and they continued with the Lord. And they were encouraged by Barnabas and others who had come to help them. But I want you to think about these conversions. What is it that these four conversions show? You have the conversion of half-breeds, in essence. You have the conversion of second-class, if not third-class, citizens. You have the conversion of a man who probably did more harm for the cause of Christ early in his life than anybody ever did or anybody could even ever imagine. But yet he was converted. And then you have a man and his household, whom Peter would never have even thought that the gospel would have been shared with them. And as long as it took him, when Peter finally got it, he got it. And so did Cornelius and his household. And here's what it teaches me. The gospel, folks, is for every single person. Do you sometimes possibly think that what this church needs more than anything else is to have middle-income white people as part of it? I'm not suggesting that that's how you feel. I'm making an illustration. I'm trying to create an illustration in your mind. That would be easy. What we need to do, let's go convert people who there's no baggage. There's no ethnicity issues. There's no race issue. There's no socioeconomic issue. Let's go find those people and we'll get bigger and we'll do what the Lord wants us to do. But let's do it in the kind of way that we want. And Acts 8:4-11:19 says, It says no. It says every single person should have the gospel preached to them. In essence, the gospel is for all people. How do you see the gospel? And let me ask you a different question. How do you see this? Because this is more direct. How do you see your role in the gospel? I am going to tell you something. When I hear people talk about this kind of thing, the gospel is for all, I don't particularly like it. I don't. It's a lot easier to preach on it than it is to listen to it. I will tell you that. Of course, I'm listening to it tonight. As I preach it, I'm pointing at you and I'm hearing it. It's me. I'm talking to me. But I am not overly pleased with my past. In terms of my attitude, maybe toward those who are without the gospel. And I'm asking you tonight about your attitude toward those who are without the gospel. All people have souls. We all know that. And my perspective has changed about my approach to saving souls. I see more opportunities now at 58 years old than I did when I was even 48. And over the past 10 years, some things have changed pretty dramatically for me personally. I have fortunately been given an opportunity to go overseas and do some work, especially in Costa Rica, which is where I've done most of my work that's been out of this country. And that's a result, at least initially, that's a result of a man and his wife, a man named Walt Hunter and his wife Louise, who came to our building in Tampa at University Church there several years ago on a weekday to do some work in the resource room to prepare some classes for Wednesday night's Bible class. And as they got out of their car, they noticed a man and a woman and a child walking on the road about 100 or so feet in front of them. And they noticed that this family, the man and his wife, were kind of looking at the building and they're kind of pointing to our building. And apparently we're talking to each other. And so rather than just assuming he had just gone into the building, Walt, as what he would typically do, by the way, he went out and stopped them. And they stopped. And they asked him some questions about that church. They were pointing to our building and asking some questions about the church. Sergio was asking in a very broken English, and his wife, Selah, could not speak any English. And their daughter, Veronica, who at the time was probably 7 years old, she could speak pretty good English, but she didn't really know what to ask. And so Walt encouraged them to come. And the next week they did. And soon, because of Walt's teaching primarily, they obeyed the gospel. And not many years later, just a couple of years later, Sergio came to me and said, "I have something I want to ask you." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "Would you go to Costa Rica and tell my family about Jesus?" That's how he put it. I said, "I would love to." And since his request, I think I've made 9 trips, me and some others as well. I'm not trying to tell you that to pat myself on the back, because there's nothing that I've done to be patted on the back for. But I'm telling you that for this reason. Had Walt Hunter not approached that couple and just invited them, I don't think I'd ever gone to Costa Rica. Now, there may have been some other possibilities. As we talked about Sunday morning, God could have possibly planned that a different way. But I've had some opportunities to go because of that. And what it's done for me, folks, it's helped me personally understand that the gospel is for all. How do you see prospects? You know, you may be sitting here going, "Well, this is not much of a meeting sermon." Well, I think it is. I think it is, because I think personally, I think probably most every church that I've ever known about or been a part of or preached for probably needed to hear this sermon. And there is a great need for all of us to improve, I think. And I start with myself. This lesson usually makes people uneasy, and I think, frankly, folks, that is a good thing. And I would very simply tonight just encourage you to think about these 4 conversion stories and ask yourself, what is it that I'm doing to share the gospel with the world? You don't have to go to Costa Rica. You don't have to leave Conway, Arkansas. But I think what God is requiring of us is that we do what we can to try to reach people with the gospel. And if you're not doing that, let me strongly encourage you to consider that. Jesus said, "The fields are white for harvest." We've heard it a long time. And whatever it is that you can do to better what you do in regards to that, I would encourage you to do. Understanding that the gospel is for all. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, the gospel's for you. Or if you're here tonight and you have rebelled against God, you have in essence shaken your fist at Him and said, "You know, I'm just not going to do what you want me to do, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not going to do that." I am going to tell you this. If you have been a Christian and you're feeling that way, and that's how you're living your life, God is not pleased. You have on your own disconnected yourself from God. And if your heart will change, He'll forgive you, but it's going to require a change of heart on your part. We're going to sing a song. And we hope that by singing this song, it encourages you to respond to the gospel, which is for all. We can help you. Come as we stand and as we sing.